Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore joining us. And today, visiting us after hours at the book club, we have James Anderson, whose latest book is The Never Open Desert Diner. In fact, it's your first novel.
It is.
It's not the first I wrote,
but the first I published, yes.
To me, when I read it, I hadn't realised it was your first novel. And I was very surprised when I heard that, because it just, you know, the characters are so well fleshed out. It just seemed like somebody who's well able to write a book and who has written before. Do you know what I mean? I was just surprised when I heard that it was your first novel, because that's a compliment, by the way. I don't know where
I certainly take it as a compliment, but I didn't so much graduate from high school. I was sort of released into the wild, and when people were attending classes and whatnot, I was writing. I actually finished my first novel when I was 16, and I continued to write. And I think Never Open Desert Diner is actually my seventh completed novel, but it's the only one I ever tried to publish.
Well, it has such, you know, there's such a confidence in the writing. The writing is, you know, dialogue is right on. It's very enjoyable. The characters are dynamite. I mean, it's just it really is a true pleasure to read. It's an easy read, but that does not mean that it's not complex, that it's not it doesn't have depth. But it just goes down easy, and then before you know it, you've got all these things going through your mind. And I spent part of my time reading this when I was down in Santa Fe, and I took a pretty deserted hike when I was down there, and it was fun to have these characters in the desert bouncing through my mind as I was going through this somewhat deserted landscape in Santa Fe. You told me when I tried to arrange this interview that you were in the desert or you were in Utah with a film crew. So what was that about, and could we possibly get a movie out of this at some point?
Out of The Never Open Desert Diner?
Sure, yeah.
You know, it's one of the most asked questions about this book, and it's one of those things that I have no control over. You know, I have film agents, and I hear that they're in meetings with so and so, and but basically, that's just it's just flying bullshit. And frankly, my job is a writer. Mm-hmm. I'm a writer. That's what I want to do. And one of my favorite writers is Michael Chabon. Mm-hmm. And Michael Chabon, and I quote him often, says, the only thing you really have any control over is the blank page. And whether your book gets published, whether you get reviews, whether you win awards, whether they make a movie out of it, he said, you don't have any control over that stuff. The only thing that's important is the blank page, and if on some core level you're not in love with the blank page, don't do this. And that's the way I feel about it. So I don't know whether it'll be a movie or not. We made a short film, based on the new book Lullaby Road, and it's essentially told in images. Boulder composer Michael Dalala has written original score around a Leonard Cohen song, and we have a wonderful Native American actor, Cosme Duarte, and five incredible Hispanic and indigenous children that are in it, and it gives a sense of the story. So That's how that came about. It's also directed by Kent Youngblood, who is a terrific director. So it has amazing production values. It gives you a real sense of what it's like to be in the desert and in that particular story.
And where is that available for viewing?
It's actually, it's in post right now. So it should be out in, 45 days. At some point in advance of the release of the new book.
You know, we asked these movie questions, and I had a movie of this book running through my head the whole time I read it. You know, these images, the light and the openness, and in some way, a real movie might never equal the the movie that's in your head.
And absolutely. I felt I was watching the movie while I was reading it. It was so cinematic and cinematically written. And we talked in the book club version of the interview about the details and how you're very detail-oriented, from the colour of shoes. It was a turquoise cowboy boots, the pink Converse shoes, and then the chrome in the diner. I could just see the highly polished, you know, diner in the middle of this dusty desert and Walt taking such good care of it. So I'm not sure if an actual film would be able to live up to the images I've actually created in my head.
Well, you know, Dennis Lehane, who does a lot of film work, I mean, you know, the Mystic River and Shutter Island and so on, is very savvy about this. Films made from books are not the books. They're and my sense has always been they're a translation. So Dennis says that Mystic River is not my Mystic River, it's Clint Eastwood's Mystic River and so on. So filmmakers, it is so collaborative. They, all of those people bring something to the table. And so it's not going to be the book, but maybe what they bring to the table will make it something else, something grander. I don't know.
You were a publisher for quite a while, and maybe you could tell us something about those experiences and how those experiences informed your going about getting this published, and you know what it was like being on the writing side of that equation. But first, maybe you can talk a little bit about the publishing.
Well, I actually started my little publishing company when I was 21 years old. Mark Twain once said that all you needed to have to be a publisher was ignorance and arrogance. And I was 21, so I had both in ample supply. I didn't have any money, so I was working a number of jobs to be able to publish these books that I believe so deeply in. This was in the early to mid 1970s. But then by the time I was 25, these books, the books that I was publishing were being reviewed in national media, New York Times and so on. And I did that for 20 years. To this day, I was joking with some friends of mine in New York not too long, I think of myself as a recovering publisher. I actually have as much and honestly probably more enthusiasm for the works of others than I do for my own. And I think that's why I didn't really, all those years I was a publisher and an editor, I didn't try to publish. I felt that the work that I was doing as a publisher was more important.
But now you're about to publish your second book. Do you feel more that you can wear that writer's hat and title? Or is it still sitting a little bit uneasy with you?
Oh, it still sits uneasily with me. I'll meet people on planes or whatever, and people always, you know, they say, well, what do you do? It's very difficult for me to say I'm a writer. It doesn't come out easily. It comes out much more easily to say I'm a reader, in fact. But no, I'm trying, and it is easier now because I'm not also a publisher.
Publishing's gone through enormous changes in the last 20 years. And, you know, I wonder, you know, when you came in publishing in the 70s to when you left and progressed in the 90s or around 2000, if you said you did it for 20 years or so. And
yeah,
then,
Brighton Bush closed when, I think, around 1990.
Yeah, and then you look at publishing now, it must almost seem like a somewhat of a different business to you than what you did, or do you think it's more similar than different? I mean, the industry's been under a lot of strain the last 20 years.
Well, I think you have to take a long view, historically, of book publishing. In the 1970s, each of those houses, what they now call the legacy houses, Knopf and Simon and Schuster and Farrar, Straus and Giroux and so on, they were run usually by one or two, three people's sense of taste and so on. In the 1970s, huge multinational corporations started putting together their media empires, of which we now see how that's all played out. But they started buying these publishing companies, and instead of the companies being run by people who love books and cared about these sorts of things, they're being run by accountants who are looking for trends. So there's been a huge change. And it's not that, because I often hear this, that there aren't people, as many people who read as there used to be. Oh no, there are many more people who read, but not necessarily books, because there's so much out there to read. And while there is, there's reason to be somewhat discouraged about books sometimes, about the reading of books, we have so many more ways that that language, spoken word, stories can be brought to us. E-books as well as the regular vessel for an idea, the physical book. Yeah, there have been a lot of changes, but finally what it really comes down to, for me anyway, is that what we love about books lasts. And there is a certain, there are people who, no matter how much huge success they have, they want a book. They want a book. It is the smallest part of what they do. And years ago, I have to admit, I was laughing about this, that Snooki from, Jersey Shore?
Yeah.
She writes a book.
Yes.
That enters the bestseller list. And I thought, isn't this strange? Somebody who can't write, doesn't read, publishing a book for people who don't read.
Well, I mean, how many books has Donald Trump published? And he very happily says he doesn't read books.
Well, and the fact of the matter is that Donald, let's not go there, as they say, but people want books. They still want to be a part of that. There's some sort of cultural capital, personal capital that comes from that. And I applaud that, but I separate that from the people who work in the fields of literature.
Well, as somebody who was a publisher for many years, and I suppose a professional reader who's just now getting used to wearing the hat of being a writer, what do you like to read personally?
Oh my goodness.
Or what are you
probably
reading right now?
I probably read 300 or 400 books a year.
Puts me to shame.
Man, that's like one a day.
But I read very quickly. I taught myself to read. I was diagnosed as being what they used to call then retarded when I was very young. And in fact, I was ADD and dyslexic and perhaps, my sister says, even mildly autistic. But what happened was I had to teach myself how to read because of dyslexia. So I taught myself to read, and I can read quite quickly, although I do find myself slowing down because I enjoy language so much. I'm sorry I got lost on that.
I was asking you what you're reading right now, reading.
You know, there are so many people whose works, and of course, if you're a writer, all your friends write. You know, reading theirs, and the same as when I was a publisher, I was interviewed one year for the New York Times, and they were saying, well, what are people in the industry reading? And I talked to a number of publishers after that, and we were all laughing because we lied our asses off, because most of what we're reading never gets published. You know, you were reading manuscripts and whatnot, but just a quick overview. Luis Urrea has a new book coming out called House of Broken Angels. I love Luis's work, so I just finished reading that in manuscript, thanks to Luis. But Bryan Stevenson's Just Murphy, Just Mercy. So I also read, I read physics, I read neurobiology. Let me think of what else. I read everything James Lee Burke writes. So many. And I reread other things. I read some of my favorite books over and over again, and I'm always amazed at how, no matter how many times I read it, it's a different book every time I read it. And I just finished reading Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, which was published in the late 1960s. So I'm reading new things. Jonathan Galassi, who is a publisher of Farrar, Straus & Giroux, wrote a wonderful novel about the publishing world of fictional characters called Muse. I read an incredible amount of poetry. A lot of fiction writers don't read poetry. They don't get it. For me, poetry informs the possibility of language. And if you consider yourself a writer of prose, not to read poetry, well, you're doing yourself and what you're capable of a disservice. So I'm reading Sandra McPherson and Billy Collins and William Pitt Root and Iris Sadoff and Aliki Barnstone and Ed Hirsch and so many truly terrific writers. And for me, reading the sciences, especially physics, where you have to invent a language in order to describe what doesn't exist. That's, I don't pretend to understand the physics that I read, but it transports me and it elevates my own prose.
But Arson, you're a big poetry fan.
Yeah, we have a group at the store, the Living Poet Society, where every month we lead a group on one book of poems, and there's about, anywhere from 8 to 12 people come, and we've been doing it now for over 10 years, so we've read over 100 contemporary poets, including a number of the ones he mentioned. Ed Hirsch is up pretty soon. I think that's going to be our December read.
Billy Jones, is that when The Rain in Portugal?
Billy Collins.
Oh, that's Billy Collins.
Yes, Billy
yeah.
Collins, yeah, of course, and William Pitt Root we've read, and I think poetry is very vibrant right now, and I would highly recommend people to read at least a little bit of poetry. You know, I know people seem to be adverse to poetry. Maybe they didn't have a good experience in school or something, but poetry can be very immediate in a way that prose can't. And poetry can do things with images and that go straight to your brain, I sometimes think, in a way that prose can't. And so it's an important part of my reading life is to read some poetry.
Well, and there are so many terrific poets in Colorado, in this area, and I love the fact that I'm thinking of poems by Meg Kearney and also Lee Upton, who I think lives in this area. But what happens is that, and I, when I was growing up, I thought that the requisite for being a writer was you had to be dead. Because I am, it's the 1960s and I'm reading John Greenleaf Whittier and Wordsworth. And then I got to discover William Stafford and Gary Snyder. For a lot of people, you're thinking about stuff in the past that was written. There is that immediacy. And what happens is that sometimes prose, you read it, and the story, and it goes through. What I try to do in my own work is to achieve what good poets achieve, which is it enters and then it makes a home in you for a while. And stays, for lack of a better word, it's it haunts you, and it grows in meaning, and that's what poetry does for me. So I read a lot of it, and of course, so many of my friends left over from my publishing years, and plus new ones, are the poets.
Mm-hmm. In terms of your own writing, I mean, we both, myself and Arsene, observed how much we love the dialogue. The dialogue is just so spot on in your book. Do you collect bits of dialogue if you're out and about and you hear just
a good
one-liner? Do you have a little notebook just full of witty retorts that you're like, I'm going to drop this in somewhere?
Well, you know, again, I think that has to be naturally occurring. And I learned so much about dialogue from a friend of mine, Stephen Huff, who's also a writer, that good dialogue is not linear. It's that he said, she said, where somebody will respond to exactly the question asked before. No, that's not how things work. I listened to my mother and her friends play cards, and there were five women at the table, all having five different conversations. You have that sense, and you have to have forward movement. And there's also the beauty of the non sequitur, which it seems like a non sequitur because it doesn't, it seems to appear out of nowhere, but yet it goes to what the subtext is, what somebody's actually thinking. But when I look at great dialogue, somebody who I met and spoke to a few times years ago, he passed away a few years ago, is Robert B. Parker, who wrote the Spencer novels. Really, really great dialogue moves in a way that I have friends who are actors and playwrights, and I will often come to them and say, Will you read this to me? Because in my mind, I hear it only one way. An actor, a playwright, they will come to you and something that you think can only be heard and understood one way, they'll give it to you 10 different ways. So I draw upon all of those resources for my dialogue.
There's been so many books that have been ruined by bad dialogue. I mean, the plot can be great, you know, the writing can be really good, and then the dialogue just lets everything down. So I'm a fan of good
dialogue. That's the ear. I mean, for whatever I do that's good in dialogue, it's the poetry, especially the beats, and even as far back as people like Kenneth Fearing and the Bardic tradition. All of those tributaries flow into this.
I like how you talk about the indirectness sometimes of good dialogue. I think of good dialogue to me, to some extent, as like a spiral staircase. Like you want to get from the first floor to the second floor, but you're going to make a few twists, but you're kind of often circling around, but you are moving it forward. Like you do have to get from the first floor to the second floor, but it's a spiral staircase. I always like to think of it as heading up to that next level.
Well, and sometimes you don't necessarily get to the second level from the first level. You get to it from the fourth level, coming back down and then go back up. So taking all of it, the dialogue that's really boring is, yes, he said, no, she said. People don't talk like that. I mean, you don't put into dialogue what is understood or what has no forward movement. And at the same time, dialogue is always giving you tone, atmosphere, and character. It has to do all of those things, otherwise cut it out.
There's a piece of dialogue towards the end that I'm just going to read real quick. This is John the preacher with his cross, and he's talking to Ben. After the actions all happen, things are kind of settled down, and John says to Ben, "If you don't mind me saying so, Ben, I think you're spending too much time alone." "No, I don't mind," I said. "You think spending more time with people will change that?" That reminds me of that quote that you said, like, sometimes the best cure for loneliness is solitude. So maybe the best cure for spending too much time alone isn't necessarily being with people, but just the beats of that, it's very, just cracks you up. And that was a part of the story where you could use a laugh.
Well, but the thing is that I believe that that's true. How many times have we heard people say, I never feel more alone than when I'm with people?
Yeah, the loneliest place is in a crowd.
Yeah. So all Ben is doing, because Ben, a lot of this is internal monologue for Ben. And so you have his voice and his sensibilities. And so when John, who spends more time alone than Ben does, he's hauling this cross up and down this desert road day in and day out, says to Ben, of all people, I think you may be spending too much time alone. And Ben's going, yeah, what do you think? You know, so again, that's that goes to character. That goes to sensibility. And to truth, the truth of it, yeah, spending more time with people is not going to change that, and you and I both know it.
Were you always going to be in Ben's head, first person, for this book? Did you ever play around with different ways of telling it? You have so many great characters, and so with Ben, you're really in his head. You get his thoughts, of course, and you see the world through his eyes. But there are so many other openings in some ways, it seems like, that you could have told this story, or it's almost, you can almost tell the same story again from Walt's point of view or something, you know. So was it always going to be Ben? Was that voice come very early in the process for you?
I'm not afraid of work, and whatever is in service, the best way to tell the story. Years ago, Ken Kesey told me, I grew up in Oregon, and so I knew Ken from a young age, but he said, you know, all you can ever really do is the work. And I will take everything that I write, I try in third person, second person. I rewrote that entire book in third person. I had already written it once in first person, just to see how that changes the story. And I really like the idea of somebody telling the tale. Also, these works are keyed off of, at the beginning, you see where I thank the characters of Raymond Chandler and Robert B. Parker and so on. And first person is the detective noir go-to. That first person, even if it's Mickey Spillane. And so I wanted to be the teller of the tale. I wanted Ben to be the teller of the tale, first person. So hearing that voice. But yeah, no, I wrote it every different way, and then chose what I thought was the best way to tell the story.
Well, I'm glad you did. And as you said, Ben is really the connective tissue for the whole thing. So I'm so glad he's coming back in your next book.
Well, thank you.
James Anderson has been our guest at After Hours at the Radio Book Club. His latest novel, his first published novel, is The Never Open Desert Diner. Thank you so much.
Thank you.